With his production partner, Ed Zwick, our guest Marshall Herskovitz created the TV series 30-something and Once and Again and produced My So-Called Life. With Zwick as co-producer, Herskovitz has written and directed a new drama for the internet called Quarter Life. It's about creative people in their 20s going through a quarter-life crisis and centers on a young woman named Dylan, played by Betsy Tulloch. She wants to be a writer and finds her own voice when she starts a video blog reporting on her life and inner feelings.
It's my curse that I can see what people are thinking, what they want to say and can't say, who they want to be with. And what good does that do me if nobody can see me?
Quarter Life was just picked up by NBC for broadcast in February as an hour-long series, but Herskovitz made it expressly for the internet, cutting each one-hour episode into 6 8-minute video pieces. They're available on the website MySpace. They're also available on a new website called Quarter Life, which was created by Herskovitz in conjunction with the series. Quarterlife.com is also the website on which Dylan, in the series Quarter Life, is posting her video blogs. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, spoke to Marshall Herskovitz.
I would imagine that here you wrote all these episodes trying to figure out what 25-year-olds were like, and then you get those scripts out, you produce those programs, and then you start hearing from actual 25-year-olds being inundated by what they're actually thinking and feeling and doing.
Yes.
How close did you get?
Well, remember, I do have access to 25-year-olds in my own life. The genesis of this project came from the fact that Ed Zwick and I realized that our entire office was filled with 25-year-olds, and we were listening to them talk every day, and they were talking to us. And you know, we've had this longstanding odd interest in various moments in people's lives, you know, whether in their 30s or in their teens or in their 40s. And all of a sudden we looked at each other and said, hey, people in their 20s are kind of interesting. Let's do a show about that. And of course, you know, we dimly remember the fact that we were once in our 20s. And in fact, you know, that was a remarkable time in both of our lives. First of all, that's when we met each other. It's when we became best friends and creative partners. That's, you know, when you're in your 20s, you end up, whether you like it or not, making decisions that affect the rest of your life, who you may or may not marry, what field you go into, whether you pursue the career you wanted to or whether you give up on it. All sorts of things happen in your 20s that are quite remarkable.
I wonder if you could compare and contrast Claire Danes in My So-Called Life with Betsy Tulloch and her character of Dylan in Quarter Life.
I guess, you know, the character that Claire played was a darker person than Dylan in this. I would say My So-Called Life is in general a darker show than this show is, and I think that was intentional on my part. You know, My So-Called Life was this very true document of what it's like to be 16 years old, and the stakes when you're 16 really do seem life and death every day. And I think that's what Winnie Holtzman so beautifully evoked in that show. My favorite episode of My So-Called Life was the one we called The Zit, where Angela Chase has a pimple. And the show ranges around philosophically all the way from race relations to Kafka's Metamorphosis. And there's nothing silly about that, because in the world of a teenager, the presentation of self, you know, puts you in the same level as racial prejudice or anything else. And in fact, you know, people responded to that very, very strongly.
Is 10 years enough distance for you to look at something like that and give yourself a grade? I remember at one point in his career, Kurt Vonnegut graded all of his novels and gave some A's and some B's and C's. Can you do that with your work at this point?
Yeah, I can. Well, first of all, you know, My So-Called Life is mostly Winnie Holtzman's work. I mean, I am so proud to have collaborated with her on that. And, you know, I wrote and directed one of the episodes, and I was there every day helping her. But this was her voice, and the pilot was Scott Winant's direction. And so it's easy for me to look at that and say, this is genius. You know, I don't say that about myself, but I can say it about them. So I'd give that an A+. In terms of my own work, Mm-hmm. I would say there are a few episodes of 30-something that I think are pretty damn good. I think there are a lot that are good and a lot that were less than good, and a very few that were really, really good and that I'm proud of.
Is there one that really leaps out that you'd like to just remind everybody about right now?
Well, I think the episode for me that sort of went into another sphere altogether was the one called Therapy. And it had an intimacy in it, talking about the issues that a married couple sort of face, that was really kind of startling. And when you look at it again, it's still startling in a way. And again, it was so honest. The octane of truth was so high in that that it just kind of knocks you out and still holds up today. So I would say that for me was sort of the one that kind of gets me from that whole series.
I love that phrase, the octane of truth.
Well, we used to joke about that, Ed and I, when we were doing the show. We realized that in general, in 30-something, if the octane was too high, it would start to freak people out and they didn't like it. And if it was too low, then they didn't believe it. And we used to say, we need to be around 92 octane of truth for this show to be at its optimum performance.
More my so-called life questions. The audience that program had wasn't valued then, but it's all that's valued now.
Yes.
Am I right about thinking that?
Yes. I would say that's the one time in my career when it can be documented that I was ahead of my time because the networks had no interest whatsoever in teenagers at that time. Teenage girls in particular were completely invisible to them. In fact, you'll laugh at this, but when we were trying to keep the show on the air, we called Bob Iger, who was head of the network at that time, and we said to him, you know, you're not losing money on this show. We know you're getting a premium from advertisers. So this is not a question of money. We know you have low ratings, but you should keep the show on the air because it's corporate good works. You are literally giving a voice to a group of people in the culture who have had no voice up until now. That's literally what we said to him. And it started to change right after that show was canceled. In fact, I would actually chart the change to the Romeo and Juliet film with Claire Danes and Leo DiCaprio that was a huge hit, like just 6 months after the show was canceled, that started this sort of youth and in particular teenage girl sort of thing in the culture where all of a sudden advertisers and marketers and film studios wanted that demographic. We were just a bit too early for it.
You're president of the Producers Guild of America, which
yes.
is different from the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, against whom the writers are striking. So you're not the target of a strike.
Thank you for saying that. That's correct.
But what's the difference between these two? How are you different?
If you go to the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, you won't find any producers. Those are big companies and executives. You know, they are represented by the six major media companies that dominate all media in the United States. Producers are people like me who try to get projects done. They are generally independent. Sometimes they have deals at studios, but they live by their wits. They live on their own. They try to get funding for the projects they love. They are much more aligned with the writers and the directors in this town than they are with the big companies that run the show. So it's actually been very important for us. We've been writing letters to Variety and Hollywood Reporter and the Los Angeles Times, trying to get them to stop referring to the AMPTP as producers, because they're not.
Well, you did an essay in the LA Times, just printed just a couple of days after the strike began, about what's happening to television, not just about the issues of the strike, but about the issues of corporate ownership. And you basically said that government policy and corporate strategy are poisoning the TV business. I mean, what's happened since you started that is so different?
Well, the biggest thing that happened was the decision by the FCC in 1995 to abolish its financial syndication rules, which, to make a very long story short, allowed networks to own the programs that they broadcast. Until then, networks were precluded from owning the programs that they broadcast because it was felt that it would give networks too much power if they did. And boy, that was a wise decision mm-hmm. back in the 70s when they passed that. And when this was abolished in 1995, which, by the way, was around the same time that these very large media companies started realizing that they should be acquiring networks so that they could be these, you know, sort of consolidated entities, that all of a sudden you had Disney that owned ABC and also had its own production wing. You had the same thing with NBC, the same thing with CBS, the same thing with Fox, that all of these networks owned the programs that they broadcast, which meant that all of the independent production companies, of which there had been like 40, say, in 1990, were driven out of business because these companies only wanted to do business with themselves. And what you have now is a network, since it owns the programs, has a lot of proprietary interest in how those programs are going to be developed. And they take much more creative control over the product than they ever did before at any time in television history. They, you know, they tell the producers what clothes the people should wear. They have to decide who the director of photography is. They tell them to change the color of the walls. They give notes on every page of the script. They, you know, they're the owners. So they want to have complete creative control. The problem, as I said in the piece, is that the people exerting this creative control are executives. They're not artists. They're not writers. They're not production designers. So they're not necessarily equipped to be making those decisions. And what you have then is decisions by committee and decisions by research. So it's very difficult to be creative under those circumstances.
Now, you're maintaining control of Quarter Life, not only editorial control in what you're doing, but you're maintaining ownership.
Yes, that's correct.
And yet NBC has bought it, or bought the second rights to it, to be able to show it in, I guess, February on TV.
Yes.
And NBC is going to benefit from the strike, I guess, because, hey, look, it's original programming that you were actually making to get away from the networks, and yet here it is. I don't know. I don't know where the chicken and where the egg is here, because you made network quality program for the internet, probably the first one that really can be called a network level show as we know it for the internet, and then the network takes it back. So it's sort of like just another development arm. How do you see it?
Well, I see it somewhat differently from that, and I think it's important to elucidate, because, especially because of the strike. I think, first of all, it's important to know that we made a deal with NBC 2 months before the strike that was quite an extensive deal. They invested in our website. They became our distribution partner for worldwide rights for the show, and they had an option, a right of first refusal, it's called, for a network play. So they had not decided whether they were going to put it on television, but they had the right to do it. And that was concluded 2 months before the strike. So there was no legal basis whereby we could withhold this from them, once they picked up the option, even though we were in the middle of the strike. We had already finished writing all the episodes, and in fact, we were in the last week of production. So, this wasn't done to give NBC fodder, to resist the strike. This existed before. The other thing it's important to understand is that we still own the show and we still creatively control the show. We are delivering to NBC finished episodes. They have not even seen the scripts. They don't even know what the stories are about. That's literally never happened in the history of television. So, and by the way, I said in the op-ed piece that I have nothing against television. I love television. I love working in television. What I hate is the level of control that the networks have exerted and the fact that you can't be entrepreneurial anymore. But we've been able to figure out a way to do both of those things, to own this damn thing and control it ourselves. So, of course, I'm happy to go to television under those circumstances.
In the previous TV work that you've done, you've dealt with teens. Now you're dealing with 20-somethings on the web. You've dealt with 30-something once and again, sort of got into the 40s. Are you running out of decades, or do you have definite plans to do a 50-something, an 80-something, something?
Well, Ed Zwick says the only thing left is incontinent something. One thing I can say is that the baby boom generation has never been shy about thinking that whatever it does is very interesting. So I'm sure when we're in our 60s, we'll think that that's the most amazing decade of life and we'll do something about then. I'm not sure anyone will want to watch, but we'll be working on it.
Marshall Herskovitz, as a multimedia pioneer. I just want to thank you for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Marshall Herskovitz spoke with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Herskovitz's new series, Quarter Life, can be seen on the website, quarterlife.com, and will be shown on NBC in February.